Welcome to the NOLA Drinks Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink and food in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Wait, what? What? Who dat? Who dat? I know we have some listeners there in Philadelphia that listen to the podcast. Sorry. Not really sorry at all. Go Saints. That was a great game. Pretty nervous there in the first half. But we just chipped away, and then we turned it around. That's what I'm talking about. This coming weekend is going to be a good game. Kind of similar to this one, I think, with the Eagles. Not the same as they were when we spanked them a few weeks ago. And, you know, different Rams team coming in, too. They're pretty good, but we got them in our house, so that's what we're talking about here. Looking forward to Sunday, friends. Go Saints. Who dat? Got a good show coming up for you here today. We are going to bounce over in just a couple minutes to Old Rail Brewing Company in Old Mandeville, right across the lake here from New Orleans, and we're talking beer with Sal and Matt, as we often do. In this case, we're going to talk quite a bit about winter beers and some stuff like that, but we're also going to talk about yeast. And in previous shows, we've focused on water quite a bit. We've talked about malt quite a bit. We've talked about hops quite a bit, though I think we're going to come back and revisit that more in depth, probably on the next one in 2 or 3 months when we have those guys back on. We haven't really talked a whole lot about yeast, and it's such, along with water, as Matt says and Sal say, you know, those are the two most important ingredients in beer. And so we're going to have a pretty interesting conversation with those guys about yeast, the role it plays, some other different considerations in production, some things like that. If you're listening on the radio, I highly encourage you to get the podcast, because those guys stuck around for another shot with NOLA Drinks, our podcast only segment, and we get pretty extensive into the topic there, and you're only going to hear it there on the podcast. You can get that at noladrinks.com or on your favorite podcast platform, yeah, like iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, a couple other ones, TuneIn Radio, one or two more after that. But it's all there on our website, noladrinks.com. Go check it out and get the podcast only thing, friends. Next week's show coming up, we're going to be talking about barrel selection in the bourbon industry. Going to be joined by Liam Deegan, co-owner of Barrel Proof and Longway, Sean Josephs, who has a Pinhook Whiskey, and also Tracy Napolitano, who is the showrunner for New Orleans Bourbon Fest coming up in a few weeks. Friends of the show, and it's going to be a really interesting conversation talking about barrel selection, what it means, what it is, how it works, and all that. So that's next week's show. Friends, want to give a quick little note here and shout out to my lovely wife, Sylvia. Today, if you're listening on the radio, is her birthday, and happy birthday, babe. Love you very much. Had a good time celebrating her birthday with my stepkids yesterday, watching the game, having some good food, and hey, I'm on the hook to make a nice dinner this evening. So there you go. That's what's going to be happening. I'm going to cork some nice wine and all of that. But once again, happy birthday to my lovely wife, Sylvia, friends. Hey, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. Oh, yeah, you know how we're going to take this out right now. And then we're going to be back at Barrel Proof, Old Rail Brewing Company, talking beers with Sal and Matt. Come on. Hey friends, Brian Diaz here with the NOLA Drink Show. Agave Week is back with its new headquarters at the Ace Hotel in downtown New Orleans. Week-long events kick off Sunday, March 10th with tequila and mezcal tastings, seminars, panel discussions, and one-of-a-kind parties. Visit NOLAAgaveWeek.com for tickets and info. The Grand Tasting is the third annual Top Taco with unlimited gourmet tacos and cocktails from some of the best restaurants in the city. It's happening at Waldenburg Park Thursday, March 14th from 7 to 10 p.m. For tickets and info, visit TopTacoNOLA.com. All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with the WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Hey, Happy New Year once again to everybody. Just saying it again. And if you were listening at the top of the show, and I hope you were, we are here at Old Rail Brewing Company in Old Mandeville, and pleased to be joined by my two favorite beer experts and good friends, Sal Mortellaro and Matt Horney. Gentlemen, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
And to you all as well, and everybody out there in radio and podcast land.
Well, there you go, man. Yeah, it's good to see you guys again. And we're doing, as you guys know, and everybody out there listening knows, about our once a quarter check-in in the world of beers. And we're sitting here, of course, in the brewery at Old Rail Brewing Company, because we want to be sitting by the tanks. I don't want to have to go very far, Matt, to get beers.
Yeah. And right behind me is a tank full of barley wine. That's the 2018 barley wine. And that's going to be going into cognac barrels.
Oh, so, okay. Yeah. Oh, you didn't tell me that part before. when are you going to do that?
We just put the order in for the barrels, and Those should be arriving in the next couple of weeks, and we'll fill them up. And we'll release that probably next summer.
Oh,
well,
cool.
This coming summer.
This coming summer. Mm-hmm. But, and we were not necessarily meant to talk about it, but since you brought it up, I think it's really interesting. So when you buy a cognac barrel, so it's obviously a used barrel that has aged cognac, do you go through like a broker? How do you procure those?
Okay. Yeah, we go through a broker. We have a guy who, you know, we'll contact him every time we're looking for some barrels. He'll send me a list, and we'll kind of peruse that, see what we want, and go from there. And so these barrels are coming from, it's a French company that had the cognac brought over to the States, aged it over here, and you know, so they're going to be fresh. There's going to be some cognac left in them. It's kind of excited to see how much we get.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So are you inviting us over for the little cognac tasting?
Yeah, yeah.
As you bleed it off?
Yeah, sure. I got some bullet bourbon, some straight bullet bourbon in the back over here.
All right, Sal, we're going to do that during the break, buddy. How's that sound?
We are making some old fashions, for
we
sure.
We are making some old fashions.
Well, it's uncut, so.
It's uncut, dude. Boy. So no old fashions. We're just going to go blind. It'll be great, man. That'll be interesting, man. That's really cool. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things, you guys, that we were going to talk about today is we're talking about winter beers, because it is winter. Believe it or not, even here in Louisiana and in Southeast Louisiana. And let's start with a general conversation, you guys. Sal, you brought some really interesting beers that I think are perfectly appropriate to not being in a super cold winter place. And we'll get to those in a little bit. But let's, you know, it is winter time, so people are going to think things like stouts and porters, right? Or as I like to combine the two, stouter. I've created a new
yes.
genre.
Yes, the new beer style. I'll be sure to submit that to the BJCP and
please
be sure they include that in there. World Beer Cup and all of that. GABF, there's going to be a new style. So, yeah, absolutely. There is a bit of a trend and a bit of a mindset that the colder it is, once we get in those colder months, that you have to move over to these darker beers, stouts, porters, things along those lines. So that is what we have at the table here. Matt actually has a couple of darker beers here at Old Rail. He has the Pullman Porter, which he put on a few days ago, which I had two nights ago and found it to be quite lovely. So also to the stout that y'all normally have on, there is the milk stout, the cow catcher. And also he's done a couple of Dark Territory and a couple of different variations, which is a Russian Imperial Stout.
Okay. Now is there obviously, like you were talking about, sort of the weight of the beer and so on. We're used to, you know, you're not going to drink a super light, refreshing lager because it just doesn't seem to make sense with the season. But are there practical production reasons for why people drink heavier beers in the winter? Or is it really just an aesthetic kind of thing?
I think it's more of an aesthetic thing. There's definitely some of these beers, some of these stouts especially, you get into the higher ABV and it kind of warms you up on the inside. You feel full, you feel warm. And I think that's why they tend to become a little bit more ideal during the winter. You're definitely not going to want to revel in a very big stout during the summer.
Right.
For sure.
They're just kind of weighty and like...
Correct.
So the alcohol level is a consideration.
Correct.
Right?
And then the fullness it makes you feel as well.
In the body, yeah. Yep. And do you have any thoughts on that matter?
Yeah, as I'm listening to this, I'm kind of thinking of when I go home back up to Michigan, it's always been Bell's Porter or Founders Porter or New Holland's the Poet Oatmeal Stout. Why I prefer these when I go up there, I can only link it to the fact that I'm a coffee drinker. I like coffee in the morning. I like coffee in the mid-afternoon. I like coffee in the evening. But when you don't want coffee, and coffee's like a warm kind of, you know, it's a cold weather thing. It warms you up kind of thing. But when I'm sitting there watching a, you know, football game at night in the winter, having a porter is just really kind of like the same effect. It's kind of like having a cup of coffee or having a stout. It's kind of like almost a suggestion to the senses that it's providing the same kind of satisfaction.
Yeah, kind of heavier, weightier, even maybe those kind of smoky notes. And
yeah, I think it's the roast.
And the roasting.
The roast, the chocolate.
Yeah.
Because those beers aren't necessarily heavy beers. They're creamy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I add cream to my coffee, but I think it's that mouthfeel. I think it's the roastiness, more or less. It's not the alcohol, because they're low ABV beers, so... I don't know, but in the summertime, it's IPAs. I'll drink Bell's Too Hard when I go back up to Michigan, and that's all I pretty much drink when I'm up there.
Is there a difference in the acid levels on these beers?
Yeah, I would say so. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So maybe a little less acidic on some of these as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think on some of the porters, some of the lighter stouts, I think when you want to make that beer smooth, you're going to mess with the water chemistry. We've talked about that before. You're gonna try and reduce that pH level and get it back down.
Right.
So it's gonna have that robust and roastness. It's kind of the same thing with coffee. You don't want your coffee to be too acidic. You want it to be smooth, and sometimes that's why you'll cut it with cream, just kind of smooth it out a little bit. Same thing. But you know, in the summertime, you want that acidity. You know, we like our Berliner Weisses and our Gozas and things like that. And it's quenching.
That's why I was asking that question, because that kind of makes sense when you compare it, say, to a white wine versus red wine perspective. Mm-hmm.
Same thing.
Well, and Sal, do me a favor. Tell people, like, if they don't know, and I know we've touched on this maybe a show months ago. It's like stouter. Having a problem speaking today. what is the difference fundamentally between a porter and a stout? Just on a basic level.
So there is a blurred line, as Matt kind of pointed out.
Oh, stouter.
Yes, a stouter. Yes, sometimes you do get stouters. Your stout is going to be basically a stout porter. It's going to be a more robust version of a porter. You're going to get a lot more of the roasted note, the roasted character. It's arguable that some of these porters are going to be a lot more easy drinking than your stouts. Mm-hmm. But even back when these styles came to be, they considered the porter, which was a beer that was made for the porters of England, the working class, if you will, those working around the docks. The stout was not just an arbitrary name. It was literally a stout porter, a stronger version of the porter.
Okay, great. Because I was going to ask you what are the origins of these beers. And so are the origins of darker beers in that sense from the British Isles in general, or did that style predate in a modern sense? I'm not talking about going way back millennia, but do we have stuff from Germany and things like that that predate, or are we kind of looking at those darker beers coming from the British Isles? Do we know?
Well, actually, Matt touched on that subject more than you realize. Water chemistry plays a very important role in the production of beer, and actually beer styles around the world. And Matt also hit another point where he talked about acidity in coffee.
Right.
The same thing happens just like when you roast coffee. It creates acids in the coffee bean itself. The same thing actually happens inside these grains of malt. When you roast these and kiln these to these higher temperatures, you create acid inside of it. So the water chemistry of these particular areas, the higher sulfate waters tend to neutralize that acid.
That acid, right.
Basically, it's more basic water tends to neutralize that acid and makes for a much more pleasant style. And there's several examples all throughout the world. I think we talked about water chemistry last show.
Two or three shows ago.
A few shows ago. So I'm not going to beat a dead horse. But some of these styles came to be because of the area itself. That's why you find a lot of the limestone cliffs, a lot of the lime in Ireland. That's why stouts actually tended to be a little bit more predominant in that area, because that very basic
water,
groundwater kind of neutralized
and,
that
and
that
lends
acid.
Itself to creating that style to
Correct.
Make a better beer.
Yep.
So, okay, necessity is the mother of invention, as we're talking about here. That's really interesting. Cool. And I didn't know that part about the porter story either, so interesting. So let's do this. We got another few minutes before we take a break. So we're talking about here in the warmness that we have here in Southeast Louisiana, even throughout the winter. One day it's 75, one day it's 45. Mm-hmm. And so you brought us a few beers, Sal, that are maybe kind of not in the porter realm or in the stout realm, a little non-traditional perhaps. What's this first one we're tasting, man?
So I call these beers, if you will, alternative winter beers. This first beer is going to be a German Schwarz beer. It's a bit of the antithesis of a dark beer. People say, oh, I hate dark beers. But this is probably the dark beer that would turn people on to dark beer. As you can see here, it's a very dark brown in color. A lot of people may be intimidated by the color alone who don't like dark beer. But the whole hallmark of this style is drinkability. It's the smooth roast. It's a moderate bitterness beer. You're going to get a lot of chocolate, a lot of coffee out of this beer without those acrid notes. Mm-hmm. This is a German style beer. It's a lager. So it's a very clean fermenting beer. It's quite lovely beer.
I like it a lot. I was posing for a photo there to show off the beer. You're supposed to keep talking, but that's cool. what you said, these sort of coffee notes, I get, there's a creamy note to it, like we've talked about, though. as well. What are some of your impressions of this?
It's kind of like a semi-sweet chocolate. It's not offensive. It's not over the top. It's not bitter. It's really nice and smooth. It's got a little fruitiness to it. It's kind of borderline on like what was that, the Cascading IPA. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like that without the dry hop additions.
Okay,
you know, it's nice.
And when you said that on second taste, more of the chocolate note pops to me, and mm-hmm. I get there's a raspberry note mm-hmm. that I get to it. That sort of dark mm-hmm. berry yeah. note. That's mm-hmm. very specific on that kind of fruit. Mm. That's really nice, and it's got a very nice body to it, and there's a nice yep. acidity to it as well.
Yep. So this is a local brewery, Great Raft Brewing out of
Shreveport. Yeah.
Shreveport, reasonably corrupt is what this one is. Mm-hmm. Not a true traditional German Schwarz beer, but it's a very good American interpretation of it.
What would differentiate that?
Generally the higher hop rates. Okay. If you ever hear an American IPA or an American barley wine, a down, fast, and dirty way to quantify that is it's got more hops. That's okay. That's a fast version.
Pretty simple. So this one has more hops than the German side.
It's probably a little bit. This is a
so higher IBU consideration on this then. We're tasting.
This is probably about a moderate bitterness in regards to on the bitterness scale, if you will. So
for this style of beer. Okay.
Yes, it's a little more hop forward. Okay. The malt plays a little bit greater role, I think, in the German Schwarz beer, but.
It does. It does remind me of a porter to a degree. Some mm-hmm. of that smokiness definitely reminds me of a porter, mm-hmm. but the body, the weight of it is much lighter. Yep.
Yeah, and you're probably getting some of that lightness from the lager yeast.
Okay.
So
and something we're going to get into towards the end of the show. We're going to talk a little bit more about yeast and mm-hmm. and how that plays an integral role in bringing out particular flavors. Mm-hmm. Right, is probably a good way to put mm-hmm. it.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, let's do this, you guys. Let's taste one more real quick. How's that sound? We got about 2 minutes, 3 minutes before we got to take
a
break.
That'll work. So the next one that we have is a stout, but it's a bit of a different stout. Okay. It is a sub-style of stout. This is what's called a tropical stout. As opposed to being your typical stout, this is going to be a lot more ester forward. We'll talk about that later in regards to yeast. So it's a lot more fruity. It's a higher ABV beer, higher alcohol beer, a little bit drier and a little bit more drinkable. It's a tropical stout because a lot of these are produced in tropical countries. Jamaica has what's called dragon stout. This is going to be lion stout out of all places, Sri Lanka.
Let's go ahead and pour that, Sal, because we'll do this and we'll probably cut to a commercial and then we'll come back and talk a little bit more about it. Thank you. So looking at this guy, keep telling us about it, man. So it's out of Sri Lanka, which is, of course, in the Indian Ocean.
Yes. Kind of a bizarre place to have a very quality beer. This, as you can see from the color, this is a lot darker beer with a mocha-colored head. You can kind of see the legs forming on the side of the glass.
I mean, it looks like a stout. When you see it and you hold it up to the table, it looks like a stout with the way the head looks and the coloration looks.
But when you drink it, you'll actually see that the fruity esters come out a lot more, that those roast notes get subdued to the background. Mm-hmm. You get more alcohol. You get more fruit. Mm-hmm. Vinous. It has more of a vinous quality.
What do you mean by that?
More of a wine-like quality.
Wine-like quality, yeah.
Than a regular stout.
I find it because it harkens a little bit to me because exactly that, like a barley wine.
Sure, yeah.
It has that kind of pull to it where it tends in that direction, that vinous note, as you talk about.
There's a lot of complexity with the malt, with the esters, the yeast esters. You're not going to. It's a little thinner body. Thinner body again, which makes it easier to drink. You know, it's not very heavy, but it's still a pretty high ABV beer. I think this is about 8%, if I recall.
Okay.
So it's kind of up there, relatively speaking, for a stout.
Body's not quite as heavy, like
8.8%, pushing 9% alcohol.
What do you think about it, man?
It's really interesting. The flavor on it's very nice. It's hard to describe, though, but I think melding that with a barley wine, it's like a light barley wine, mm-hmm. but it's really dark. Mm-hmm. This is fun. I do like this beer. It's been a while since I've had this, and now coming back to it and talking about it and kind of breaking it down, this is really enjoyable.
Yeah. Well, let's do this, you guys. We'll take a little break here on the show, and then we're going to chat about this beer during the break, and we're going to come back and regroup on this one. And we're going to talk a little bit more about non-traditional winter beers, and then we're going to have an interesting conversation about yeast. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the Noah Drink Show. Come on back.
Hey friends, Brian Diaz here with the Noah Drink Show. Agave Week is back with its new headquarters at the Ace Hotel in downtown New Orleans. Week-long events kick off Sunday, March 10th with tequila and mezcal tastings, seminars, panel discussions, and one-of-a-kind parties. Visit NolaAgaveWeek.com for tickets and info. The Grand Tasting is the third annual Top Taco with unlimited gourmet tacos and cocktails from some of the best restaurants in the city. It's happening at Waldenburg Park Thursday, March 14th from 7 to 10 p.m. For tickets and info, visit TopTacoNola.com. Laissez-les bon temps brûler. Brian Diaz here with the Noah Drink Show. Yeah, from the city that shares a deep connection to bourbon and knows how to throw a party, comes the third annual New Orleans Bourbon Festival from March 20th through the 23rd. Discover over 150 bourbons and American whiskeys, as well as great food at the Grand Tasting. Check out more than 30 seminars led by industry luminaries, special distiller dinners, and much more. The event is brought to you by Beam Suntory, Four Roses, Brown-Forman, Uncle Nearest, Bourbon Plus, and the Hilton Riverside. More info and tickets at nobourbonfest.com.
Now if you ever been down to New Orleans, then you can understand just what I mean. Now all through the week it's quiet as a mouse, but on Saturday night they go from house to house. You don't have to pay the usual admission if you're a cook or a waiter or a good musician. So if you happen to be just passing by, stop in at the Saturday Night Fish Fry. It was rocking.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening into the Noah Drink Show.
You never see that scuffling and shuffling until the break of dawn.
One of my favorite subjects, and always.
It was rocking.
Matt Horney and Sal Mortivaro, and I should mention, Matt, you are the brewmaster here at Old Rail Brewing Company, at which we sit in a certified beer judge in your own right. And Sal, you are also a certified beer judge. And let's mention this quickly. You're about to be in the world of beer.
Yes, I got tasked to be the North Shore correspondent for the Louisiana Craft Beer Magazine. That is something that the Louisiana Craft Brewers Guild is putting out. It is a magazine that covers all the beer happenings throughout Louisiana. It's going to be distributed at various locations, rest stops or rest areas, tourist places, as well as bottle shops, the respective breweries, to kind of cover the Louisiana beer scene, promote the Louisiana beer scene. And I'll be covering the North Shore breweries, Hammond as well. So. Correct.
Awesome. That's pretty cool, man. Congratulations
Thank
on
you.
The gig.
Yep. Looking
and
forward to it.
You're a good guy to do it, man. You're definitely a good guy to do it. So check it out. And people, if you're listening from afar, you might go, well, that sounds pretty niche-y. But actually, we got a lot of good breweries over here on the North Shore of New Orleans, and Louisiana's got a great beer scene going on. So that is a wealth of material from which to draw, is it not?
It is. It is. Again, it's put out by the actual State Craft Brewers Association Guild. And it's going to cover everything beer-wise that's worthwhile in the state.
Awesome. That's part of, I think that coincides with the state of Louisiana as well. So they're actually providing state funding to that.
Yeah, so like tourism
cool.
funding coming into it.
Correct.
So yep. That's really cool.
Yep.
Well, you guys, we wanted to circle back really quickly on the Lion Stout there from Sri Lanka because we had a little more time during the break to chase through and get our heads around it. And Sal, you had some thoughts, man.
So we talked about another layer of aspect was, as you noted, the prune, the fig notes, very multi-layered, very good depth of flavor in this particular style of beer. Grape notes, both in the vinous quality as well as flavor, prunes, fig. It's going to be, like I said, a scaled up sweet stout with a lot more fruit esters.
Kind of sitting a scaled up sweet stout and a rolled back barley wine, maybe, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. Matt, do you have any last thoughts on that one before we move on?
No, I just think that if you can get it and you can find it, it's worth a shot and try it. It's unique and it's different.
Yeah, what we were kind of gossiping about during the break here is there is some word that we're going to give this a plug. I don't normally do this for a brand that I have no involvement with, but Lion Stout from Sri Lanka, if you can find it, go buy it because it may be going away, at least within the friendly confines or not so friendly confines. Of the United States, so go check it out.
Or if any of your travelers head out to Jamaica for vacation, very similar beer is Dragon Stout out of Jamaica.
Okay, so a similar approach.
Correct. It's the same style.
Okay, cool. What are we doing now, Sal? We're going to move on. You brought a really cool barley wine.
I did. Also, kind of an alternative winter beer. I brought a traditional English barley wine.
Okay.
This is J.W. Lee's Harvest Ale from 2012. These particular beers are going to be higher ABV. These are pushing 12.5%. I'm sorry, this one's 11.5% alcohol, pushing 12% alcohol. You're going to get a lot of very deep rich bread notes, candied fruit, sherry notes from oxidation in a good way of the beer, as well as like treacle pudding, high sweetness, low hop bitterness, beautiful, beautiful kind of beer that you want to sit and sip by a fire.
Nutty on the nose.
Oh,
man.
Yes.
Big time nutty.
And that's going to be your oxidation of the malts.
Yes,
so sherry, nutty, almond notes.
So now is this allowed to age then in the cask and oxidize a bit? Where are we getting that oxidation from?
Each house is different, but you got to remember this is a 7-year beer now, 2012. Okay. So I would not be surprised, and don't quote me on this, but I would not be surprised if some of these folks do let just a touch of oxygen in the bottle. Normally you want to purge that oxygen out. It wouldn't surprise me if they let a touch of oxygen in just to allow these flavors to develop over time.
Yeah, absolutely. This is really interesting because there's an earthiness on the nose. Mm-hmm. There is an amazing amount of mineral to me on the palate. It's almost like licking a rock in your driveway, which I like to say, like a good Pinot Noir should have that, and not nearly as much as this, but a good Pinot Noir needs to have a high level of minerality to me to actually work. And this beer has that kind of, like, I don't want to say chalky because maybe you think that's bad, but it's like licking a stone. There's mm-hmm. huge minerality on this. It's very pleasurable. Mm-hmm. What do you think, Matt?
I agree with everything that you just said. I get the caramel notes in it. I get that going back to the malt, to the beginning of it. The malt kind of just spews out that caramel note, but it's subdued in a way that it's different than a fresh barley wine would be. The almond note,
the nutty notes,
the nuttiness is like, it's like a nut and butter kind of thing going on.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But then it kind of changes into, it's, I don't know, it's weird. It's kind of like a slight tobacco-y kind of mm-hmm. thing.
Yep.
That's that, like, that kind of earthy note, mm-hmm. I think, is also.
And that lingers on the palate, on the tongue, the cheeks.
And I think, we'll have some pictures here up on our Facebook page and on the posts and stuff where you can see this. But I think, like, lots of times when you drink a barley wine, you expect it to kind of be that deep, I'll use the word brooding, kind of malty, mm-hmm. grapey note. Mm-hmm. And this is actually much lighter. It almost drinks like a sarsaparilla or a root mm-hmm. beer kind of consideration than, mm-hmm. you know, like a Old Nick kind of barley wine would.
To me also, too, there's kind of a fun play. And it almost reminds me to a certain extent of one of my favorite Amaro's Chinar. There's a sweetness to it, mm-hmm. but there's a bitterness to it.
Good point.
There's an earthiness to it.
Yep.
What's kind of fun, too, is that over time, time subdues alcohol. So when you drink this thing, you don't realize it's pushing 12% until you keep your mouth closed and you exhale out the nose a little bit. You get a kind of a little burn on the nostril.
In that finish, mm-hmm. right.
In that finish. Yeah. But there's just this, when you're just drinking it, there's this lovely just softness to it for a 12%, and it's a very... very thick mouthfeel, a very full body on this.
Mm-hmm.
Just time. It just shows what time can do to a very lovely beer, how it can make it complex and more tame all at the same.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it has a great, like you said, it has a great mouthfeel, but it's not a medicinal mm-hmm. kind of mouthfeel. This is a lighter drinking barley wine than many. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, you look at the color. I mean, if you were to actually pour this and look at it, it's a golden golden brown.
It's a lot
color
lighter. Mm-hmm. Our barley wine comes in a lot darker than this, and it's a lot more robust in its nature.
It's a very different style.
Very different. This is, I think the color says it all.
We're holding this up so you can, well, you have to, we're on radio, so you're in podcast. Go check out our Facebook page. We'll make sure we get a good picture of that and good little video in there. Tell people where again is this from and who is it?
So this is J.W. Lee's out of England.
Okay.
Traditional barley wine in that it is going to be more malt forward and a good bit more subdued on the hop bitterness. We talked about the American precursor, if you will. In American barley wine, you're going to be a lot more forward on the hops. But what's interesting about the American barley wine is that if you let these things, a very good example, even though it's not a barley wine, is the Dogfish Head 120.
Okay.
You drink a fresh Dogfish Head 120, that hop bitterness is over the top. It's very, very bitter beer, very hop-forward beer. But if you let these beers sit over time, it slowly but surely becomes more of a malt-forward beer. And it's not that it becomes sweeter. It becomes less bitter.
It becomes less bitter.
So you still have the amount, same amount of residual sugar left in these beers. English barley wine, traditional English barley wine, it's more malt-forward beer, a little bit less dependent on the hops. Thomas Hardy barley wine is kind of the premier example. In my personal beer cellar, I have four bottles of a 81, 82, 83, and 84 bottle of Thomas.
Cool. Awesome.
So I'm kind of waiting for something special to open that up.
Awesome. Let's do this, you guys. We're going to take a little break here on the show, and we're going to come back, and we're going to give you a little 9.5 minute or so
give
primer
me
on yeast, friends.
A great big glass of wine. Give me a great big glass of wine. It's 8:45, and I still got a little more time. I got to have it.
We say Le Bon Temps Brûlé. Brian Diaz here with the NOLA Drink Show. Yeah, from the city that shares a deep connection to bourbon and knows how to throw a party, comes the third annual New Orleans Bourbon Festival from March 20th through the 23rd. Discover over 150 bourbons and American whiskeys, as well as great food at the Grand Tasting. Check out more than 30 seminars led by industry luminaries, special distiller dinners, and much more. The event is brought to you by Beam Suntory, Four Roses, Brown Foreman, Uncle Nearest, Bourbon Plus, and the Hilton Riverside. More info and tickets at nobourbonfest.com.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here at the WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans. And in podcast land, wherever you may be, thanks for listening in today. Yeah, we're here at Old Rail Brewing Company here in Old Mandeville. Address?
639 Girard Street.
639 Girard Street, and it's, what's the website?
That's oldrailbrewery.com.
Old Rail. Come check them out. Great program. These guys have been on the show before. Matt Horney, brewmaster here. Sal Mortellaro, certified beer judge. You guys can get their credentials. They're online. They're on the show all the time. But we want to talk about, in this last little radio portion here, talk a little bit about yeast, and I encourage everybody to stick around for the podcast. If you're not hearing the show that way, you're hearing it on the radio, go get the podcast on your favorite platform or at noladrinks.com. So we're going to get a little more into the weeds about yeast. But Matt, let me flip it to you. We've talked about water before on previous shows. We've talked about barley. We've talked about hops. Mm-hmm. But yeast is a component that people maybe don't know. You're not just using a yeast to make beer work. Different yeasts do different things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of breweries do reuse yeast. They kind of recycle their yeast, which is great. It's financially a viable way to do it. But here, I do that when I can. But
we're going to talk about that in the podcast. What that means.
But what I like to do is just focus on the strain and the style. And our focus here, and me and Sal were talking about this the other day, was the thing at the Old Rail is that we like to just brew anything. And so we don't sacrifice any of that to whatever kind of strain is available of yeast to us based on the style. So when we do an IPA, we will use an American strain. When we do our ESB, we use an English strain. When we do our lager, we use a German strain. When we do Saison, we use a Belgian strain. So we could have all of our fermenters filled up with every kind of strain across the board, and we might just discard that yeast. And it's all just to achieve that style of beer, and that's our main focus.
And what people maybe don't know then when you're saying this, Matt just rattled off a list of beers and those styles that come from those places. That's their provenance from those beers. And what you can do then, Matt, correct, is these days you can actually procure yeast, these yeast strands that are true to these regions. Those are those yeasts from those regions.
Yeah. In our Saison, which we're going to be brewing here shortly, we're going to bring back our strawberry pepper Saison. We use a DuPont Saison strain. So that was cultured from DuPont, and it's now manufactured.
And DuPont meaning?
The DuPont Saison is like one of the, it's a world-class Saison.
Yep.
A lot of people probably have had it. A lot of people, you'd recognize if you saw the bottle. Yellow and green label. So that's kind of the epitome. It's like the high end of a Saison.
So that's what you want to source, is to stay true to it. You're going to go for we talked about before, the key ingredients, the type of hops, the water chemistry is going to be that way. Mm-hmm. And we need to have the right yeast strain to be true to the style.
Yeast is next to water. I think yeast is probably your, your next most important thing, because without that, you won't have the product that you're looking
you
for.
You won't achieve that flavor profile.
A lot of flavor profile comes
from this. Well, you have to remember there's a saying, and I've said this before, that brewers make wort and yeast make beer.
Right.
So yeast is very important to the actual production of beer itself. It produces a lot of these nuances. It produces, and we'll, I guess, talk about this in the podcast section, a lot of these esters, a lot of these phenolics that are important to that style of beer, that really defines that style of beer.
So these are these aromas and the tastes that we're talking about here when you say esters and phenolics. And so it's very important then to and so when we go through the process of certain yeasts, it's the same in wine, friends. When you use a certain style of yeast, it's going to either enhance or maybe even in some cases take away from a particular set of particular flavor profile, correct?
Correct. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, if you have a good clean lager, if you will, the whole point of the lager is it's a very clean fermenting beer. You don't want to use a German-style strain, which will produce what's called a lot of isoamyl acetate, which is a fancy word for banana esters.
Yep.
You don't want a lager that smells and tastes like bananas. Not okay for the style.
Because it'll in a lager, you're going, it's a lighter beer, so that... In certain beers, that's going to tuck in nicely, right?
Yep.
But in a lager-style beer, what's going to happen is that's going to overwhelm the beer.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So when working then with yeast, because we're talking about, like Matt, what you were saying, bringing in different types of yeast into the situation, you have to be careful with your selection. You have to know what you're getting into. But then I think we can talk at least for a few minutes before we close out the radio portion. We do get into the idea of house culturing, right? You're going to get yeast in the grooves, if you will,
that
sticks around.
We've done that a couple of times, and a lot of breweries do that. And you get in larger breweries like Sierra Nevada and some of these breweries that have kind of coined some of these traditional yeasts that you use around the country in home brewing and commercial brewing. And the California Ale is one of them. And you know, a lot of people refer to that as being the Sierra Nevada yeast. But there's a lot of breweries out there that kind of had their own protected yeast that they reuse and reuse and reuse and reuse. And if we do that here, we've noticed where the first generation, the second generation, the third generation, they start to change and they mutate. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So and a lot of this, there's so much that goes into it, and we can talk about this in the podcast half, but depending on where you draw the yeast off of the tank, you might get the yeast that fall off first, and that's the yeast that kind of, they just chug through, or maybe they don't chug through and they just drop to the bottom. And if you harvest those yeast cells and you bring those into your tank, you might get a sluggish or slow fermentation. If you get the ones that are at the very end of fermentation, you might get the yeast that just chug through and they just kept going and going and going and going.
Blast it out.
And will dry out a beer. If you harvest those, you might get a beer that's very dry and not very sweet and higher in alcohol. If you get right in the middle, which is what everybody shoots for, then you get that sweet spot. You get the blend of both. You get the healthy cells that are just kind of like happy doing, you know, whatever they're doing.
At the rate that they're supposed to do it.
At the rate they're supposed to be doing it. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of people forget that yeast is a living organism.
This is key to this.
And that's kind of exactly what Matt is saying, in that it's basically, to a certain extent, natural selection. Mm-hmm. You don't want too low. You don't want too high. You want that sweet spot right in the middle, right?
Right, certain yeast strands
really
want to
survive
certain. I mean, they die at certain levels of alcohol, right?
Correct.
So certain yeast can't perform when the alcohol level gets high because they're dead.
And you have to manage your tank pressure. You don't want to overpressurize it. You want to keep it healthy. Too much pressure will kill them, and you have more problems after that. You know, the cell walls burst, things like that will start happening. It's an interesting gamut to go into. In the sense of brewing beer, because you think it's just easy, easy, easy. Let's just like brew beer, make wort, pitch the yeast, and go. But when you start getting into the living culture side of it, like Sal was saying, it's a whole different thing, and it's really interesting.
That's a key part of what we wanted you all to understand here in this part of the conversation, is that, you know, probably a lot of folks out there know that there's different types of hops that are going to do different things, different types of barley. How you treat the barley, right, is an incredibly important process. As we've talked about on previous shows, water and the water chemistry is going to change, as you said, Matt, the most important part of making beers, and especially if you're trying to recreate or create your ode to a style versus doing a house style like Sierra Nevada or something that you're talking about. And the one thing that we haven't really talked about in much detail until now is yeast. And there's a huge selection of yeast out there available to you that you can buy, that you can source. And then you're making a choice about what your business model is as far as I am trying to create my ode to this style and be true to this style, or am I trying to be Sierra Nevada, where everything has like a Sierra Nevada note to it? Mm-hmm. And we're not knocking that. That's what they do. They're a big brewery, and that's what their model's built on. Well, Matt, do me a favor. Circle back. We've got about a minute left before we're going to close out here. Circle back once again. Old Rail Brewing Company, where can we come see you?
So if you're heading cross Causeway coming from the city, we are to the east, East Causeway or Monroe Street. Take that to Girard Street, and we're across from the right next to the fire station, across from the St. Tammany Trailhead, St. Tammany Market. Trailhead Market that happens on Saturdays is also there. But we are here Tuesday, 639 Girard Street, and we're here Tuesday through Sunday, 11 o'clock through 9 o'clock, and then Friday, Saturday, till 10:30.
And good food. Good food here. You can eat good food, good beer that you can only buy here at the brewery, by the way, just saying. Sal, real quick, when can we see the magazine, man? When's it coming out? Do we know?
So it'll be coming out. We have to get our first stuff in by the 15th of this month. So we'll probably see it. So we'll probably see it coming out within the next probably March time frame.
Beautiful. Watch for that. We'll put it up on the Facebook page, friends. We're going to close out the radio portion here of the show. These guys are going to stick around. We're going to talk more about these on another shot with Dollar Drinks. So if you're listening on the radio, friends, remember to be kind to one another. Use your turn signal. And until then, everybody, thanks for sticking around for another shot with Noel Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you. Hey, it's brought to you by our good friends at Top Taco and Agave Week. Check out toptaconola.com and nolaagaveweek.com for information, tickets, all that good stuff coming up March 10th through the 14th. Hey, want to give a quick shout out to our good buddy Sal Mortellaro there, who's on the show. We're going to be kicking it right back over to Old Rail Brewing Company for our continued conversation, talking about yeast and other things related to beer. But one thing that happened after we taped the interview versus now, right a day or two after, is Sal learned that he passed his Grand Master level test, certification test there with BJCP, the Beer Judging Certification Program, and that makes Sal one of about 65 Grandmaster beer judges on the planet out of about 8,000 total certified beer judges on the planet. So congratulations to that guy. Always a pleasure to have he and Matt on, two of the most knowledgeable beer dudes around. We're going to kick it right now back to Old Rail Brewing Company. Here we go. All right, everybody, up another shot with Noel Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you. And yeah, we're sitting with my two unpaid beer correspondents. As I always like to say, it's kind of a running joke because I say this on every show, and I forgot to say it earlier, and then I conveniently forgot to bring my wallet. So you guys were actually looking for compensation during this show. Sorry, boys.
De facto, we're still unpaid.
But you're still totally unpaid.
This is a nice microphone, though.
And you traded me some beer. Are we getting into the swap meet thing? Is this what's actually happening here? Oh, my goodness. And I didn't want to be that guy like, oh, I forgot my wallet. Not that I was going to pay y'all anyway. But anyway, yes, the unpaid beer correspondents. We're sitting here, of course, with Sal Mortellaro and Matt Horney. We're at Old Rail Brewing Company in Old Mandeville, Louisiana, just across the lake, Lake Pontchartrain from New Orleans. And as promised, we're talking a little bit about yeast. And boys, we, you know, we've talked about this a little bit before. We talked about water pretty extensively on previous shows. So, you know, go back to the website there and just Google beer, or excuse me, in our search field, beer, it'll come up. We've talked about barley before. We've talked about hops before. I think we need to do a future show and get a little further into the hops thing, as we kind of went down that rabbit hole once, but not too much. But on this one, we're talking about yeast. And in the last segment that you heard, we kind of gave you the 30,000-foot level yeast 101 consideration, but now we're getting into it a little bit further here. And Sal, you were telling me something during the break that, you know, we kind of get back to two basic species or basic families, genus, I'm not a biologist, of yeast. Let's start there, and let's go from that.
So when it comes down to it, and this is really kind of dumbing it down, this is still at about 15,000 feet.
I'm pretty freaking dumb.
Well, this is coming about 15,000 instead of 30,000 feet. There's two main yeast strains. Saccharomyces, Carlsberg genesis, is going to be your typical lager yeast strain. Saccharomyces.
So you hear the word Carlsberg in there, that
yes,
makes some sense.
Yes,
right? As to why.
Right,
okay.
as in the brewery Carlsberg.
Yes.
And also Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which is going to be your very typical ale yeast. From there, you have various different subsects. When you start getting into, Matt pointed out in the full show, you start getting into like your various German yeast and Belgian yeast and what they kick off or what they don't kick off as far as esters and phenols and alcohol tolerance and things like that.
Well, let me ask you this question, because I'm dumb, but I'm just smart enough to be dumb. And the so really kind of what we're talking about, too, with some of these yeasts are that obviously we know people have been making beer, people have been making bread, people have been using yeast for thousands of years, longer than that. So these were species, and we were talking about, Matt, earlier, mm-hmm. about mutation. So these were species of yeast that actually at a particular time where we were able to identify them as species happened to be in use, right? So there's a
correct.
Sort of a threshold here or a line that was crossed where we can say, ah, this is the yeast in play, and ah, this is the yeast in play. We had so it's almost an arbitrary line. It's like recorded music, right? Mm-hmm. Music was happening long before recorded music happened, and there's a line kind of arbitrary when we started recording music.
Well, that goes back to what, the stick?
Yeah, the magic stick. Yeah,
the magic stick. There you go.
We don't know why it works. We just dunk it in there.
We just
and it
put
works.
The stick in there.
Yeah, right. There. See, I'm dumb. I'm just smart enough to be dumb. But that's true, right? So I mean, we were able to qualify this at a particular period of time.
No, sure. And in fact, we got them even more. Finite in that. We've talked about this on past episodes. I'm not going to beat this dead horse. But we have clean beer only since the 1880s, give or take, only because of Louis Pasteur.
Right.
One of his first experiments was, why does beer spoil, become sour in breweries? Microbiology, all that jazz. He was able to say, there's the yeast under microscope. And from there, we were able to identify and compartmentalize these yeast strains that did or, like I said, didn't do certain things. So from there, I mean, they were always around. We've just only gotten cleaner beer in the last 200 years, maybe.
And this is because of pasteurization.
Yes, right? Correct.
But it within the last 10 years, I don't even know how long it's been now, with lager yeast,
yes.
They were trying to trace
correct.
The origins of lager yeast because nobody actually knew where it came from.
Okay.
And that was traced back to South
somewhere
America.
Weird, like, yeah, Patagonia or somewhere
yeah,
wacky like that.
They found it on a tree.
Yeah. Yep.
So
interesting.
I don't remember it, but I believe what I read was that they believe the wood had traveled across the ocean, mm-hmm. landed in Europe, and somebody had had a stick and
they made a magic stick out of
stirring stirring their batch of mash,
whatever.
Or
I mean, and yeast hops from things to things, as we know. So the idea, and we're now into wild speculation here, but so we're not necessarily talking, or are we talking about something where this yeast simply could have come back in the 16th century on a sailing ship? Or does it predate
that? It's possible,
right? That would seem to be more a logical vector than... There's always that idea that, like, you know, the turtle that floated all the way across the Pacific Ocean. Yeah, it's probably a land bridge somewhere in there or something. All right, never mind. This is way out of our field. But okay, so
there are articles out there where people have been trying to trace this. And the research is out there. And, like, they've only been able to trace the yeast to like a certain part of the world, and so they're wondering how it got from that part of the world to the other part of the world where the beer began,
right?
And so the lagers began,
right? So that's interesting because of the timing mm-hmm. of it. Now, could it be Also, again, wild speculation. So lagers were maybe going on before, but this yeast strand replaced another yeast strand that was being used.
It's possible.
Lagers, mm-hmm. That would seem to be, to me, sailing ships would seem to be the vector. This is a complete tangent, but back in the day, yep. When I used to do coral reef work, which I did for a very long time, and the same idea, there were invasive species that were taking place. So on coral reefs in Florida, you had all these specific species that were popping up. And all these people were making these theories, marine biologists were making these theories, that larvae from ships coming from the Pacific, mm-hmm. had these larvae in the ballast water, mm-hmm. of the ships, and then all of a sudden they're dumped on the reefs. And then what was pretty conclusively found in most cases, it's just some asshole had an aquarium in Florida on Fort Lauderdale, dumped the fish in the water, and it procreated. That's a far more logical explanation, wow. than these things surviving, mm-hmm. in ballast water. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's where I was going, mm-hmm. with sort of this as, yeah. my side commentary. That's why we do the podcast thing, because we can just get off on side commentary. But let's get back to the yeast thing. So we were talking about, mm-hmm. these sort of two categorized yeast, mm-hmm. strains, and those are sort of the top of the family tree as far as we use today now,
sure.
for the most part.
I think ale, off the top of my head, I'm not a microbiologist, but your lager yeast are, for all intents and purposes, are going to be pretty much very similar to each other. Maybe except for the Zurich lager yeast, for example, maybe a little bit of an anomaly. I made a Sammy Klaus beer once that pushed 18% alcohol.
Tell us what that is. And
so the Sammy Klaus style is a very high gravity, high ABV lager. It's made in the Zurich area of Switzerland area. Yeah. That's a very, very finite strain used for a particular purpose. But I think for the most part, your lager yeasts are going to be pretty much the same. Matt, would you agree? Mm-hmm. There's not much variation. It's really your ale yeast where you start getting that diversity.
Okay.
Your Belgian yeasts are going to put out a lot of these wacky, just crazy phenolics, peppery, smoky phenolics. Your American yeasts are going to put out some nice fruity esters, but still let a lot of things shine through. Mm-hmm. Your German ale yeasts are going to put out a lot of clove, banana, bubblegum esters. There's more from there. A lot of English strains are very fruity, very lot of apricot, pear.
Some more of that kind of stone
so
fruit.
Stone fruit. Yeah, there's such a diverse crowd in the ale yeast there's so much you really can't discuss it in 20 minutes.
Sure, fair enough. And so, this is what we're trying to get at to some of the variation in understanding how to use yeast, Matt, right? It's an, mm-hmm. incredible, yeah. challenge as a brewer.
Mm-hmm.
When you're going through, and we're going to go through a couple areas here. So when you're going through and you're doing your research and selecting, mm-hmm. style, probably go back and say, okay, here is the yeast that we know is used. How much latitude do you sometimes take to say, okay, look, here's the traditional one, and then, mm-hmm. how much latitude do I say, I'm going to try this one. I'm making this style of beer, but I'm going to use, mm-hmm. This yeast variable, and screw with that a little bit.
Right. I think for me as a brewer, and this is why every brewer is different, this is kind of the cool thing about it all, is like we all have our personal sense. I tend to default to what I want the terminal gravity to be.
What that means, if you would.
So terminal gravity is like how much sugar the yeast will consume from start to finish. Where it finishes is terminal gravity, so that's your residual sugar that's left over. So if you're at, we use Plato here, homebrewers use a different scale. If we're finishing at 3 Plato, that's 10-12 on the saccharometer for homebrewers. 3 Plato is fairly, it's a nice dry kind of.
So what's that percent RS, percent residual sugar? What would that be roughly?
That's a good question.
Oh, okay, fair enough. You don't have to do that. Go ask Plato.
if we do a beer like that, then that's determine on basis of what our actual attenuation of our yeast is going to be, which is how much sugar it can actually ferment. So we might have 80, 90, 85, 75, 65% attenuation rate on those yeasts. So based on that, based on the style I want to brew, I can dial that in. Then I can look at my grain. I can decide how many unfermentable sugars I want, what the mash temperature is going to be, how much fermentable sugar I want. How much unfermentable sugar, so we can leave residual sugar. So there's all these like variables, but it all begins with the yeast, because the yeast is going to tell you what the final product's going to be.
Okay.
So then you can go back from that, and then you can take a step up and say, well, I want more malt character, I want more hop character, or I want more phenolics or esters, depending on what style you're making. And then you can decide, based on those choices, what kind of yeast you want. And
so this yeast is going to deliver mm-hmm. this terminal gravity or this amount of residual mm-hmm. sugar. And then I can say, okay, here's three or four choices that are going to deliver right. that end mm-hmm. result.
Right.
And then pick something different based stylistically yeah. from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So it kind of like creates like a tree. Mm-hmm. The other things that kind of come into play are with like lagers, as like Sal mentioned, like alcohol content. If we were doing our Maibock or if we're doing a Doppelbock, like, can that yeast actually live through those higher alcohols?
The higher alcohols, mm-hmm. yeah, yeah. Right.
So those are kind of things that we take into consideration when we do our beer.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that we talked about too, and kind of shifting gears here slightly, because this is the second part of what I wanted to get to. We were talking a little bit about this about in the previous segment about house style, and I'm going to liken this to San Francisco sourdough bread, which is the part of the mm-hmm. world in which I grew up. And no matter what anybody tells you, when you make sourdough bread, if it doesn't come from a handful of bakeries in San Francisco, it doesn't taste like sourdough bread to me. Mm-hmm. And that's because those yeast strains have been in the brick walls forever. Mm-hmm. And yes, they mutate over time and so on and so forth, but that delivers that San Francisco sourdough flavor. So certain houses, you can achieve that. Matt, you were talking about something before we went mm-hmm. on the air about a generational or second mm-hmm. generation mm-hmm. use of yeast. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, so as you use the yeast, you harvest it. You look at the cells under a microscope. You count them. You can tell healthy cells from bad cells based on their shape. And then you can do you can see what cells are dead. You can dye them, and they'll change color. So you can do an analysis on your yeast. You calculate how much yeast you need based on the next batch of beer that you're going to make, and then you take that yeast, you harvest it, you repitch it on the next batch, and it's a great way to like reuse yeast. It's a living organism, like we were talking earlier. So you can reuse this yeast and you can use it again and again and again and again. And, you know, some breweries in Europe can use it up to 20 times. I've, you know, heard through travels, and here breweries that I've worked at, we use it up to 6 to 7 times. Here we've gotten up to 3 times.
They become non-viable, right? And they can't, mm-hmm. the fermentation rate slows.
Slows down. You need more. Okay. You need more of it. You know, everything starts to multiply. But you also will start to get different flavors on it, and that can generate a house, like a house culture. Here we try to stray from the house culture, because we don't want beers to start tasting the same. We want them to stay true to style. And so in my mind, and what I've done here is I've tried to use always fresh yeast, because I want to emulate the styles.
It's a different goal. We were touching mm-hmm, on that right. before, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. So if I'm brewing an ale, I could use California ale strain for the Cowcatcher, the ESB, and I could call it ESB. You could do all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. I don't want to do that. I want specific strains, specific styles, all across the gamut, and I want them to be fresh, and I want them to be accurate. And that's, I think that's an important thing to do. So people understand truly what these styles are supposed to be.
I couldn't agree more. And I'm going to ask you, Sal, in a second here to chime in on that. You know, we're talking about an incredibly well-run, and you're a great beer maker, Matt, microbrew here in a neighborhood. So this is what you're sharing with people. If you're going to be Sierra Nevada, you need to be Sierra Nevada that things taste like Sierra Nevada. And that's not, these are two mm-hmm. different business models. So mm-hmm. I know we're talking about yeast, mm-hmm. but these choices all play into your business model mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. But add to that a little bit about what we're talking about here with sort of house style versus true to form style.
So, you know, all of these components, because we've broken down so far in this show, water, yeast, hops, malt, all of these small components add to the overall style, right? If you change any of these things, you are going to detract from that particular style, that typical example of the style. But as Matt pointed out, I mean, really water chemistry and yeast are kind of the arguable things. You're really going to miss that je ne sais pas, if you mm-hmm. will, that if you're missing those nice esters or you're missing that nice those nice phenolics, you're really kind of detracting from that beer as a whole.
It's not true to the style.
No, it's not. Mm-hmm. It's really not.
And that's what makes it challenging, right, is that, like when we were talking about water, as we did before, where you know, if you're just sort of using municipal water, or even if you're just treating your water for every beer the same, that's not the style of beer. And this is what you do, Matt, is you are looking to be true to that style with some, obviously, with some creativity and some, some take on this, of course. Right. But this is keeping it in that regard. And the yeast selection is also an incredibly important part of this.
Exactly. And that, I mean, we can have beers brewed to style and people can say, well, why would I want that if I can just go to, I can go to a store and buy an English version of it. I think the cool thing is to have that brewed in your community and have it brewed locally and have it emulate the style. I think getting that as fresh as possible is, I mean, I don't think you can go wrong with that. I mean, we'll never get a German lager here how it tastes in Germany, but can we brew that and bring it to our customers like as pure as it can possibly be? We can probably, we can try. And I think part of that comes in the yeast and how we treat our yeast and how we go about our brewing process.
Yeah, what a great, and that's a great distinction to make. And I'll jump in here, Sal, in a second, but that I think people need to understand that is that when you're, you know, when you go to the brewery, you're going to taste the beer one way. When it's bottled, it's going to taste different than if it was coming, say, on tap or out of a keg or out of a tank, for that matter. And then it's going to be shipped. And then it's going to come over here. It's going to sit on a shelf. It's going to sit in a warehouse, blah, blah, blah. And beer is not something that is meant – well, okay, there are exceptions. This is not something like a Bordeaux. In these instances, most often that we're talking about, and there are exceptions. Don't crucify me for this. This is another show about laying beers down. But, you know, the idea is that it changes rapidly in a short amount of time in a way that is not necessarily desirable. And so getting that true to form the way it is supposed to taste, the only way to actually do that in your neck of the woods is to do what Matt's doing, right, Sal?
Correct. And, you know, on the BJCP scoring scale,
tell
if you will.
Tell people what that is, because we haven't told people what that acronym
is. So BJCP, Beer Judge Certification Program, it's kind of the worldwide gold standard of beer judges. Approximately 8,000 beer judges throughout the world. Your higher-ranked beer judges are going to judge very big competitions, such as the Great American Beer Festival, if you will.
He's one of those guys, isn't he, man?
He is.
Yes. Okay. So, you know, they're on the BJCP scale, there is a difference between a very good beer and an exceptional beer, right? It's those intangibles that really kind of make that nuance, that make it like, oh, man, that's a phenomenal example of the style. That's a phenomenal beer that you take a sip of, kind of like when you took that Lion Stout, you're like, that look on your face, you're like, oh wow,
right?
You know, it's just that just intangible that makes it, just sets it above the rest from everybody. It's those little small nuances that add to the sum, add to the whole.
That's great. And it's, go ahead, Matt, you're gonna say
Yeah, and just thinking of what Sal's saying, it's like those nuances. And when we see reviews online, you know, every brewer kind of dreads the untapped kind of thing, but when people respond to, you know, tasting the Helles and they say it tastes like Budweiser, it's like, you know, there's so much more behind this beer, because if you look at it and you break it down, it doesn't really taste like Budweiser. But there's those nuances, there's those subtleties, and that's, I think, where that specific Helles strain of yeast comes in, and those German malts. Yeah.
And I mean, I guess maybe too, from some degree, if you're saying it tastes like Budweiser and you want to look at it this way, it's maybe a compliment, because it means that people are tasting in a way,
right?
Because it's a good, consistent, clean lager, right?
Yeah.
And we've talked about that on the show before, that you know, you can knock butter, do whatever, but it's a consistently clean lager, relatively. And so I think where people that are the non-knowing, you know, might be like, wow, it's actually, they don't know any better, so that the idea is that this is actually consistently, and it's clean, and there's nothing that's throwing me out here. And that's, you know, what that's like the Budweiser business model, right?
Sure.
Budweiser drinks that way, drinks the same way all the time, and credit to them for doing that. Doesn't taste like the Helles, like you said, at all. But to the untrained palate, or the non-knowing palate, or less experienced palate, I don't want to denigrate anybody. There's a consistency there, and there's a cleanness there.
Right.
So you don't have bad notes going on in it that are distracting.
That is true. That could be looked at as a compliment.
I mean, it might be, but it actually
I mean, when you look at it that way, when you break down a lager and you look at it, and if somebody says it tastes like Budweiser, that is a very clean beer. That is a very hard beer to make, and that's a good way to look at it. That's a positive way to look at it.
There you go. And I'll say fuck Yelpers, but here we are. That's cool. I'm trying to make it positive. Well, Sal, on that note, you wanted to make sure that people here in this part of the world, if you're listening to the show here in Southeast Louisiana or in Louisiana in general, tests coming up. If you want to become a beer judge, you can.
Yes, absolutely. So, again, we kind of touched on the BJCP. We will be having a tasting exam held here in Mandeville, Louisiana on May the 5th. So if you are interested in becoming a beer judge, you can go ahead and take the tasting exam. More than likely here at Old Rail, it looks like, okay. If not somewhere here in Mandeville. If you're on Facebook, that's the easiest way to get on it. We do have a Louisiana BJCP group. Find that. It will give you all the to-dos, how to prepare for it, the things you have to do before the exam, and get you signed up for the exam to be a certified beer judge.
So resources to study.
Yes, it'll have all of that stuff.
Okay.
There's a whole gamut of resources, and we'll point you in the right direction on the group itself.
Yeah, and also if you're listening outside the area, go to bjcp.org, and there's similar things that are going to go on. In
absolutely. There is, like I said, it is a worldwide organization with approximately 8,000 judges in the world. So there's tasting exams all over the U.S., all over the world at any given weekend to do.
Cool. Awesome. Gentlemen, thank you very much for taking some time out talking beers, talking yeast this time. Mm-hmm. And we'll do it again here in the spring. We'll use this will be terribly punny. We'll use spring as a springboard to talk about spring beers. God, that's just awful. It's probably time to end the show. Friends, we're going to take a little brief musical interlude here on Another Shot with Noel Drinks. I'll be back with my parting shot.
All right, everybody, thanks for listening to the Noel Drinks Show this week. As always, friends, certainly appreciate your listenership and being a supporter of everything we do here at Noel Drinks. Want to mention next week's show. I touched on this briefly at the top of the radio broadcast in the beginning here of the podcast that we're going to be chatting about the barrel selection process in the bourbon world, sort of what that means, how it works, why people do it, so like why people make barrel selections and buy them, why producers supply them. Be a very interesting conversation. It ties in to a certain degree anyway with New Orleans Bourbon Festival, Friends of the Show. That's coming up a Wednesday, March 20th through Saturday, March 23rd. Going to be a great event. We'll certainly talk about the event because the showrunner for that event, Tracy Napolitano, is going to be one of our guests along with Liam Deegan, who is the co-proprietor of Barrel Proof, a very fine whiskey bar in the lower Garden District, as I like to say. Liam's a frequent guest of the show. And also Sean Josephs, who is the owner of Pinhook Bourbon. So it'll be a really interesting conversation with those guys. Looking forward to it. We're going to do some tasting. Again, talk about barrel selection and some good stuff like that. So be sure to tune in to that show. And the podcast will be out, you know, after it airs on the radio and all that good stuff. Y'all know the routine. But here's our parting shot, and just kind of building a little bit on what we talked about with Matt and Sal in the world of beer, some things that got me thinking in that interview. You know, it's important to visit your local brewery. I think it creates a unique experience. There's a lot of personality there. There's a lot of unique approaches to beer making, a regional approach, a local cultural approach to beer making. And, you know, of course, it's good for the local economy. It helps raise revenue for the local tax base, of course, and it supports local jobs. Here in Southeast Louisiana, we have about 35 or so breweries alone just around here and just about everywhere you are listening around the United States. And all over the world. I mean, geez, we were tasting some beer from Sri Lanka, and I know it's not quite the same everywhere, so I'm not making sweeping generalizations, but the small brewery movement in recent years is a very widespread. So many, many, many of us have the opportunity to go visit local breweries. And one of the things that popped up that I thought was really interesting was this conversation that we had talking about, you know, breweries that go for a house style, you know, a style, a taste and flavor profile, a certain approach, whatever that may be, to their brand, regardless of specifically what beers they're making. And that style versus the approach of truly trying to emulate the classic or true to the style, if you will, versions of the beers. You know, some of these classic European styles, old world styles, things like that, or even new world styles. These are two totally different business models. And I found that part of the conversation to be really interesting, you know, thinking down those lines of what it is that you're trying to accomplish. I'm not saying either one is better or worse than the other. But I think when you're looking at something, hey, you know, if you're a brand and you're trying to build a house style, that's awesome because that's what you do and that's what people will associate with you. I think if you're trying to emulate and recreate, if you will, true to form classic styles of beers, this is also really awesome. For one reason, you know, as we know that beer is generally best when it's fresh. Now, certainly there are some exceptions to that. We talked about that even on this episode, that there's some certain beers that are age-worthy, certain beers that are even designed to lay down, but the vast majority of beer is meant to be consumed when it's fresh. So, you know, one of the things that we know then is if we're drinking some of our favorite brands and styles from Europe, by the time we get it here in the United States, just using that as an example, it's not going to taste the same. It's certainly not going to taste the same as it tastes in the brewery's tap room or even, you know, at a local restaurant or bar or beer shop for that matter in that neck of the woods. So folks like Matt that are trying to pursue this approach of emulating and recreating these styles that are true to form is probably your best bet to actually taste what some of these styles are actually meant to taste like. Now, we all have our favorites and big brands and certain imports and things like that. But again, I'm urging you to try the local stuff for that reason. Not only is it good for the economy, but you're going to be able to explore these two different approaches, right? Depending on what the brewery's doing. What's their house style? What's this local brewery up to? Why are they making the beers the way they're making them in their local cultural context? Or if they're looking to do like Matt does, emulate these styles and be true to form in that regard, it's a great opportunity to taste beers in a way that you would never be able to taste them otherwise if you're buying, you know, imports from overseas on the shelf in the grocery store somewhere. I think it's really, really fascinating. So, you know, when you get out there, go out and try some of these breweries. Mix that into some of your routine. Get out to them and ask them, you know, what they do. What are they going for? Are they going for a house style? Are they trying to emulate a classic style? Are they kind of combining the two? You know, also be sure that if you went to a local brewery, especially a newer one, and it wasn't so great, give them a second chance. I've learned that a couple breweries here just in the local area, and of course I'm not going to name names, that I visited not too long after each of them opened within the past 2-3 years is what their timeline has been thus far, and neither one of them was particularly good. But in going back to both these breweries, they have improved greatly. I think what we know, and this is kind of a tangent, but I think what we know is that a lot of folks open up a brewery because they were very successful or good at home brewing. And scaling these things up is much, much more difficult than some people might think. Also dealing with local water, listen to our show that we did with Sal and Matt not too long ago talking about that stuff. There's a lot of things that come into the mix when you're actually trying to produce beer commercially that just don't exist when you're doing it in your kitchen. So a lot of these folks learn the hard way and, you know, give them another chance. Ask some of your friends if they've been there. Have they gotten better? Are they working at it? Do they hire somebody who actually knew what the hell they were doing to brew the beer and help them out? Maybe consult, something like that. So, you know, again, mix some of these local folks into your beer regime. I think it's an important thing to do because the beer might just taste a little bit better. Why? Because it's fresher and because you're supporting your neighbors. Friends, that's our parting shot. Here's to you.